Here's the other thing. We're accommodating them. We said, you guys come on and we'll give you a place to stay and we'll finance you. So when you start looking at the numbers, the staggering numbers and the hundreds of thousands that we're giving apartments to that are in shelters, we just had it happen in New York, I think 3 days ago. And you can see that on my website. I wrote about it on there. I think it was 3 days ago, where they discovered that there was a whole group of TDA that was manipulating everybody in the shelter. They injured a couple of people. I think they murdered somebody outside of the shelter. They're controlling a migrant shelter in New York City.
San Diego 911 emergency.
You need to come right away. There's a man with a gun and it's loaded.
Receiving emergency signal from
54 George, 1141. We got a white female down. We need paramedics closely.
All available units roll code that way.
Welcome to the De-Escalation Conversations podcast. Today, I have one of my favorite people in the entire world on with me. And for many years, E.G. Weiss has been on the front lines of America's disasters, including our crisis at the border. Eddie has been researching and presenting on the effect that our border crisis is having on America and created TDA Shadows. And you can find that at tdashadows.com. And it's a project funded through the Life in the Arena Foundation. And he has also now written a book about our country's newest threat, Tren de Aragua. I didn't know much about Tren de Aragua. I mean, I heard a few things. I heard about Aurora, Colorado, heard it, and then I heard it was a bunch of BS, and then I heard, no, it's not BS. I didn't know much. And Eddie and I were talking one day and he opened my eyes. And what I did was this. I put everything else on hold. And I said, Eddie, people have to know more about this. They have to know about it from the expert, you. And you need to be able to take this to our listeners. So literally, I tore up the entire podcast plan for season two and started fresh. And Eddie's episode is the first episode of season two, specifically because this stuff is so important to your personal safety. I don't care if you're a law enforcement officer, a firefighter, a medic, if you're a K-12 school teacher, you're in corporate, I don't care. If you are walking this planet in the United States, you need to be aware of this threat. So Eddie, thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. This is going to be great.
I agree. Let's take a step back, because starting this tdashadows.com, writing a book, you have really, well, you, as I said a moment ago, you've been on the front lines for decades. But this particular threat that's facing us right now, how did this become important to you?
It was an awareness that it kind of almost washed over me while I was working on a project back in 2021, where I was involved with a lot of the unaccompanied minors. And you remember that that was all in the news in 2020, 2021. We had all of these people coming across the border. Of course, they were bringing COVID. But then there was all of the politics. And so, you know, we had children in cages and all of that. You know, what happened was the news stories, the news cycle wore out really quickly on all of that. And it was because both sides were to blame. And so they didn't like that. You know, they did the whole pointing the finger. So Foro was pointing back and both sides did that. So one of the most major things that occurred in 2021 that only hit the news cycle very briefly was the fact that we took thousands of teenage boys and put them in the Dallas Convention Center. They had all come into the country almost at once over a period of several weeks. There was no sheltering space for them at all. And so the Dallas Convention Center was pinpointed as a location to push them through. There is a new documentary out called Line in the Sand that that talks about some of the failures of our system and how when they brought all of those in, I was placed overseeing a majority of the operations there. I was watching these boys, and they were fighting age males in the countries that they came from. Here, they were young teenage boys. So humanitarian aid is what we were doing. That was how it was labeled. That's not what I was seeing. I immediately picked up on the fact that they would gather in small groups, whispering off in corners. They had their cell phones when they arrived, and they were in constant contact. I noticed overwhelming similarities. They would literally show up. I'll give you an example. We would get a young boy that would show up, and he would have a sandwich bag. And this is what he had come across the river with. And in that sealed Ziploc was a phone, some money usually. And then every once in a while, you'd see a rosary, but there would be a scrap of paper, usually no larger than a post-it note, handwritten with a name and an address. So when they would come into the intake process, they would open that Ziploc and they would hand us that paper. Well, that was their aunt, Aunt Consuelo. She lives in New York. Or this was Uncle Julio and he lives in Denver. But there was no way to really vet that. And so the system was that we had to reach out to these people whose names were on this piece of paper. Well, now we're talking about hundreds that were showing up all the same way. The little Ziploc bag, the little written notes. It was like, wow, there is like a system. Like I think there was people giving away Ziplocs at the river or something, because it was awfully weird that they were all like this. Well, what would happen is we would reach out to these people and say, are you Aunt Consuela? Well, of course she is. So now we were taking literally temps that were going through a training and driving or flying with these children and dropping them off with their relatives. Now, whether or not they were all really relatives or not, I have no idea. The vetting system was so poor. But then the directive came that we had to start moving 1,000 at a time. Get them in, get them out, get them in, get them out. The humanitarian thing stepped in hard on us. And you can't keep these kids locked up, because remember, that was the big deal in the news. Can't keep them locked up. So keep in mind, they were in a convention center that was wide open and they were all playing soccer in their socks. It was fun. But so they weren't locked up, but they were detained there until we found a home. The problem was that when they started saying, you got to move them 1,000 at a time, that vetting system went down to literally almost minutes. So two things were happening. We were catching some of them in lies as to even how old they were. And so we'd get 18, 19, 20 year olds that were saying they were 14. And then the other thing was we were adding staff as private contractors like crazy that really shouldn't have been vetting anybody. But that's who was doing that process. So in other words, we became a travel agency, and with the United States government money. When I started noticing the little clicks, the conversations, when I started eavesdropping and starting to gather intelligence, I started noticing tattoos, similar tattoos. And the more I asked questions, the more I found out a bunch of these kids, even though they're 14 years old, 12 years old, these were TDA. These were the Tren de Aragua gang members. I am convinced now, looking at where we have our hot spots, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, Arizona, Denver, New York, even out west, this was a plan. And it was a smart plan. I have a background in the faith-based community. And this is exactly how you plant a church. You send people out to witness in the neighborhood until you get enough of them. Then you start a home fellowship. And when that gets big enough, you build another church. This is how church planting works. And Tren de Aragua was very smart, because that's what they did. Think about it now. These kids are now all 18, 19, 20 years old. They're all in those locations where we saw the hot spots of where, oddly enough, they all had relatives. And now here they are out on the streets, and we're only just now hearing about it. When I reported it, I was told it wasn't a big deal. When I reported it, it didn't fit into the humanitarian aid side of things. So I was completely ignored. And I think that was the worst part of it, was that that is what completely overwhelmed me, was I knew that we were facilitating something that wasn't right.
How big is this issue?
2 days ago, there was a report that came out. The FBI is going to be adding about 100 of these gang members to their most wanted list. And they're estimating that there are 600 in the United States. However, I have a friend of mine by the name of Daniel Brunner. He's a special agent with the FBI, retired. And he was just on television last night. And him and I are in agreement that we are probably looking at numbers more like 4 to 7,500. And that would be active, dangerous, older, not playing around.
4,000 to 7,500.
Yeah.
That's a big issue. That I believe that falls in the definition of big issues.
I'm not military, but that's a good size army. I mean, we sent less people over to Israel at a time.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, that's pretty scary when you send any force of that size that all have the same goal anywhere.
Why are we only now just barely seeing this in the news?
I think one of the reasons why is because if we're going to really look at this, we're going to have to take some responsibility as to how they got here. We allowed them in, and you know, it's Halloween, so everybody's watching those movies, you know, and especially the bad ones. If you're not, you should go back to all the movies from the 1980s when horror movies changed. If there's a vampire running around in the mansion, somebody let him in. And you can complain all you want about being killed, but at some point, the person being killed is probably the person that let him in. And that's what's happened. I think that now the responsibility of who let them in, we're already starting to see this a little bit. It's like, oh, there was a problem. There was a home invasion up in Chicago. Immediately, the other channel says, well, you want to know why? Well, that Trump did that. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the next day, they take over an apartment complex and there's Donald Trump going, oh, you want to know how they got into that? Kamala Harris let them in. And it's like, so we're immediately doing it again. And so I think there's some journalists out there that are really trying, but I don't think we're really hearing about it. Like, I mean, you almost have to rephrase your question. You said, why are we suddenly hearing about it? I think it's just report overflow. I think what you're hearing right now is only what cannot be hidden. You cannot hide an entire apartment complex being overwhelmed. You know, you've got like Governor Abbott steps up and says, this is an international terrorist organization. And he deemed them such in September. But that never hit mainstream media. And if it does, I mean, God help Governor Abbott, because it's just it's going to be, oh my God, he's a racist. It's an election campaign. He just doesn't like Venezuelans. That's what we're doing with all of these issues. And, you know, we did the same thing, I think, with COVID. And I think that one of my burdens that I'm feeling right now with the knowledge that I have is, I remember when COVID started, as somebody that had worked in infectious disease control so much, it was really weird because CDC immediately said, okay, here's COVID, here's what we should do. But they didn't say that to everybody. They said that to the states. The states then said it to the counties. And the way that this trickles down, and I know you know this about law enforcement too, works this way. If all of a sudden you find out that the 1911 handgun no longer works at the federal level, they tell the handgun division, the handgun division tells the state tells the county tells your chief, and your chief is so damn busy, you might find out about it, but probably not if you're on night shift. Well, that's what happened with COVID. EMTs didn't even know what to do with COVID until 6 months in. because of the trickle down of information. The FBI and Homeland Security has known about this. They've known about this since I reported it. But they're only now starting to do things. And unfortunately, I think that that's even political too. I think that people don't realize how bad this really is and where, because oddly enough, all the news stories are San Antonio, Chicago, Denver, Aurora, Colorado. Chicago has got major issues right now. These boys, if that's what we're going to call them, that came here and are coming here now, they're all from small towns where they come from. And I'm seeing them gravitating towards what makes them comfortable. So I live in a town of less than 800 people. But that looks like home to these guys. And I'm right in between Dallas and San Antonio. So I think that one of the reasons why I'm pushing so hard to provide education is because I think every community in the United States is at risk on this one.
Yeah, makes sense. Not that IDEA is a political organization. In fact, we're actually prohibited from being involved in any kind of politics. So I asked this question for responsibility level. Is this a Biden thing? Is it a Trump thing? I'm not saying because of politics. I'm saying for two different groups of people who are approaching dealing with this problem or not dealing with it, how does that fall in?
It's so weird that we blame like those people that are way at the top as if they make every decision.
Yeah. When they don't, we know that.
And they absolutely do not. When you have the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is not, you don't vote for them. So I'll take the politics out of your organization right here. The Office of Refugee Resettlement is, they're not elected. That is the Department of the United States. They set the system up that let us in. Homeland Security has been managed for years by politicians, not experts. So I think that there's departments and divisions that are responsible for this. I don't believe that this is a Democrat thing. I don't believe this is a Republican thing. I think that this is a security issue. And there are a lot of people in charge of that that are not elected, but I think that they're being coerced into being afraid to take a greater stance. And I think what's happened to our Homeland Security is the same thing that's happened to law enforcement, you know, which I know that you talk about a lot. It's like, we want you to be strong. We want our community to be safe, but please tiptoe if you would, and try to whisper and wear all black and only go out at night. And that way people won't notice you're there.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've written a new book, Chaos Across Continents, Venezuela's Impact on America's Front Lines. Mm-hmm. Why that title?
When I run into people in my life, I try to understand them. And I know that that's a big part of de-escalation, is understanding where someone's coming from. And I can sit here and say that they're involved in human trafficking and drugs and all of these things and all the violence, but to totally understand where they're coming from and how they're able to recruit like they are in middle schools right here in Texas, we're catching them doing it. I've always said this in my books and from speaking, let's go historically back and find out where this started. How did they become like they are? You know, de-escalation doesn't start right there on the street with the guy that's angry. If it's going to be effective, you got to understand the guy's wife left him yesterday and he was fired on Tuesday. That's going to help you a whole lot. And so that's what I did with the book. I kind of took lead from what you teach and train on. And I said, let's go back and find out why they're in a bad mood. Let's go find out why they're violent. Let's go find out why they have this hunger for these things that they're after. And so the book actually goes back all the way to the beginnings of Venezuela, the upheaval and uproar that's been in that country since its very birth. This is what these people were raised in. So they are a definite product of a horrible environment. And so what they've done is they've kind of adopted a lifestyle that they believe is the only survival technique. That's how they began. In 2014, this whole thing began in the Tokoron prisons. And so they already had that mindset that, oh, if we're already guilty, then let's just keep being guilty. It's much easier. So I think understanding that is going to help us stop a lot of the recruitment and things that we're seeing now in the United States, because now I'm almost equally as worried about who they're recruiting as to how many are coming in, because those numbers could start to match very soon, which means for every 1,000 that comes in, we have two.
Yeah. You know, it's funny how you mentioned that going back to the roots. I still distinctly remember, and I know I'm probably going to get some hate from the Boston folks, but I distinctly remember there was Diane and I and two of our friends who were also law enforcement officers. We traveled to Boston, and we took a 3-day cruise to the Bahamas and came back to Boston. We spent several days in Boston. Now, if you think about how Boston began during the American Revolution, the Boston Tea Party, there was all sorts of stuff during the American Revolution that was all conflict. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because everybody that we were, and when I say everybody, not every single person, but the vast majority of people, it just had this confrontational feel to the town.
Oh, yes.
And Diane and I were walking around. I was doing this little tour thing, and they're talking about on this square, this protest happened, and over here, this happened, and this sparked this aspect of the Revolutionary War. And we, at one point, we looked at each other and went, got it. They have been arguing since Boston was born. They've been in confrontation since Boston was born. Really unique feel to that town. And what was hilarious is we were in this store and we met this really nice person. And I said to her, I said, you know, I got to tell you, you're like the nicest person I've ever met in Boston. Have you noticed it? And she goes, yeah, when I moved here, I noticed it right away.
And
she was from the Midwest. And I'm like, okay, well, now I understand why you're so nice. Okay. She's not from exactly. Boston. She goes, I've been here like 2 months, or I'm sorry, 2 years. And
well, you think about Canadians, what they say about Canadians, how kind they are all the time. Everybody's like, Canadians are just, they're always kind. They're always kind. Well, everything, the whole environment. But New Orleans is one of my favorite places in the whole wide world. And every time I drag a close friend to New Orleans for a week, they, on the second day, they're like, this is stupid. These people are crazy. And I'm like, no. They're not crazy. They understand that life is short.
Yeah.
It's a party all the time because they're about to get 40 feet of water in here again.
Yeah. It's so interesting how a town, a city, an area, in this case, a country, Venezuela, can be born or raised in turmoil and how it defines it. Because Canada doesn't have that turmoil, has never had that level of turmoil. Canada in the last 5 years has had more turmoil than in the history of the country.
Yeah.
And what are you seeing? You're seeing truckers shut down the routes of commerce and protest. That's not a Canadian thing. Mm-mm. But they're being faced with all this conflict that is raising that up. So, okay, I don't want to get too far off track.
No, but I think that influence is important, though. You know, when you think about who their leadership is, when we went after MS-13, which I think y'all did a great job on, you know, as law enforcement, MS-13's out there, but they're not out there like they were. You know, we went after the mob. We did pretty well with the mob. And, at least they calmed down and moved. But maybe they relocated. But we always went after the head, right? I mean, take down Capone, there's no more Capone group. And that's how we did that. We can't do that with this. Because what they call cranes, the word that they use is cranes, all of their leadership's in prison. So we can't cut the head off the snake on this one, because the head is already cut off and it's still alive.
Yeah.
So we can't even get to it. So all of that leadership is coming out of Tokoron prison still to this day. So we can't cut the head off the snake, which means we've got to start doing this from street level up. And that's why I think the training and the education has to be where it needs to be in the healthcare system, clinics, schools, law enforcement, EMS. How do you recognize them? Because, by the way, you can't just walk up and go, hey, are you TDA? Because that's not how they play. So you've got to learn how to recognize them, recognize the signs. You know, learn about what that graffiti looks like. You've driven by that stop sign 6 times in the last 2 months. You know what that means? They're here. They're in your town.
So TDA, Trinde Aragua.
Yep.
Tell me just a kind of a brief overview. We know it's a Venezuelan gang. Mm-hmm. You drew a parallel to MS-13. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more so we understand. Okay, so they're gang members. What's the big deal? We have lots of gangs. We have Bloods, we have Crips, we have Linkin Park, we have Logan Red Steps. We have all sorts of gangs. But this one you're saying is different. Tell us a little bit about this gang and why we need to be concerned about it.
It's interesting that when you look at how this gang operates, their roots, their very name, that whole Trinde Aragua, is they're from the Aragua region. And that train is because they were actually from an area that was a transportation hub in Venezuela. So all these guys that are in prison right now were born and raised in a transportation hub. So you go to Pittsburgh, you got all the steel workers, right? You go to Kentucky, you got all the mining people. Their children and their children's children have never been in a mine, but they can all sing Coal Miner's Daughter. They all know it. Well, that's exactly how this works. And so these guys were transportation experts. That was the environment in which they were raised. So we've already talked about that tumult, that all that tension, but now they had all of this transportation that was a specialty. So when they took all of that anger and the violence and the need to constantly be fighting and the transportation, and they put those two things together, they literally became traffickers, the ultimate traffickers. So what they did was they reached out and initially to other gangs in South America, and they said, hey, do you want to play? We're looking to franchise. And the gangs that said, not interested, we like our identity, they slaughtered them. And the other ones, the smart ones, said, yeah, we can see this partnership working. So what they did was they rose up through those gangs into the cartels like Sinaloa. Now, to let you know how organized this is, we just intercepted a memo. So we're talking about a street gang here. We intercepted a written memo. That's a corporate structure that gave permission to TDA members to start shooting Border Patrol on site down at the border.
Holy crap.
So these are businessmen. These are incredibly shrewd businessmen.
Why give the green light on that?
Fear. I think they're starting to see that their name is getting out there a little bit more in America. And I think fear. They use it well. It's been used in Venezuela since day one to control people. And so I think with what's happening in the United States and what they know is happening, they know we're distracted. The world knows that we're distracted. So if they can create that kind of fear at an upper level in our own Homeland Security system, then they're just going to keep coming right across, because they know that here in the United States, we'll spend the next 3 years doing research and studies and arguing and making it a political issue to decide what to do about this. Like, do we shoot back? Yep, one side of the aisle says yep, the other side says no. They know how we operate here. Nothing's stopping them. This is a corporate structure that doesn't have to follow any corporate rules.
Well, the decision making, there's no lag time there. All right.
Oh no, they're much more flexible than we are.
So besides that memo, what can you tell us about other recent events that should have us on edge and wanting to know more?
One, lodging is one of the issues. When you're going to move that many troops somewhere, even if it's over the course of 3-4 years, you have to build army bases. And so there's only two ways that you're going to do that. You're either going to borrow property or you're just going to take over property. That's how every military works. So like I said, these guys are smart. So when we see what happened in Aurora, when we saw what's happening in Chicago right now with the apartment complexes, we are going to keep seeing more and more for all the really old people that are listening to your podcast. We're going to see Caprini Greens again. We're going to see entire complexes that are taken over like this, because that's how they do it in Venezuela. They're going to take it over. They're going to stake their ground. They're going to say, this is our property. And we're going to have a repeat of what we saw with Caprini Green in Chicago, what, 4 decades ago. And so, because you have to house your people and you want to keep them all together, because you want to train them, you want to feed them, you want to finance them, you want to have meetings with them. So, I mean, every army throughout history built a fortress, right? The other thing is, we are accommodating them. You asked about more recent things. Obviously, we're seeing home invasions and human trafficking and drugs. But the big concern should be, one, taking over housing projects and areas. They're fighting, Bloods and Crips are backing off in southern Chicago right now because TDA has moved in on them and is going to war. But here's the other thing. We're accommodating them. We said, you guys come on and we'll give you a place to stay. And we'll finance you. So when you start looking at the numbers, the staggering numbers and the hundreds of thousands that we're giving apartments to that are in shelters, we just had it happen in New York, I think 3 days ago. And you can see that on my website. I wrote about it on there. I think it was 3 days ago, where they discovered that there was a whole group of TDA that was manipulating everybody in the shelter. They injured a couple of people. I think they murdered somebody outside of the shelter. They're controlling a migrant shelter in New York City. So, you know, it's like, it's come on, we'll put the tent up. You come on, we'll give you an apartment. We'll give you the finances that you need. And I don't want people to think that, you know, I'm all about like building a wall with no gates. You know, I've never been that way. I was a part of the evacuation out of Afghanistan, and that changed my world forever. And there are people that I love dearly that I helped come into this country from Afghanistan. I don't think we need to just shut everything off and go, you know, ape nuts crazy and just close the border. But we've got to find some kind of balance between humanitarian aid and homeland security. And I don't think we've found that balance yet. And I don't think it's about administration, because it seems to change every day. We keep toggling back and forth between homeland security and humanitarian aid. And I think that's what's causing a lot of the problems. We became a travel agency 4 years ago with these guys.
Well, all right. So you said you're living in Texas. Is this a bigger problem for you than, say, someone in New Jersey or Utah?
Two sides to that answer. Yes, because they're coming through here. There was just down just north of Juarez, there's a little town called Tortilla. I'm not able to do the whole rolling the consonants. So I'll say Tortilla.
You're in good company.
Someone will write me an email.
You're talking tortilla?
It's like that.
Okay. All right. Gotcha.
I know that there's this little town. It's just north of Juarez. I know this didn't make it to the news cycle. There was just a gunfight with National Guard on that highway.
Oh, wow.
In Texas. So, yeah, it's an issue to us here. because of proximity to the heaviest entry, which would be El Paso right now for these guys. But what I saw working the migrant shelters and the transportation of migrants, no, this is still as big a problem in New Jersey as it is here, because I know where we sent them. I know how much we
Yeah.
spent and how much time and how much effort was spent to make sure that they got to where they said they wanted to go, or where they were sent.
U.S. government largest Uber driver organization there is.
Unbelievable.
Wow. Okay, so TDAshadows.com. Your book, Chaos Across Continents, Venezuela's Impact on America's Front Lines, is available at tdashadows.com. And you're trying to educate different organizations and agencies that are impacted. Can you shed some light on who those groups are and why this is important?
Right now I'm targeting hospitals, clinics. These people are part of our communities now, and so they're using those services. So they're going to walk into the door of an emergency room. They're not going to walk in and shoot the place up. That's not what this is about. What this is about is they come into an emergency room. Do you have a basic situational awareness to recognize tattoos and contact law enforcement to say, hey, we're starting to see this in our community? Because law enforcement could be missing that. Clinics are the same. Schools, I mean, like I said, they're recruiting in middle schools right now. That's 12-year-old kids.
Wow.
So, our teachers, do teachers know what to look for? Do they know? It's not profiling. There's very blatant things that you can see that I teach on, like tattoos and writing and things like that. But, with Bloods and Crips, it was easy. It was up, all the red, all the blue. With this, a little more complicated, but still not that hard. This isn't like 8 days of training. Community centers, organizations, faith-based organizations. And then obviously law enforcement and EMS. I think that there's not an entity that doesn't need to have some kind of awareness, so that a lot of people think that maybe the slogan changed or we got rid of this. We used to say no to drugs, and people are like, ah, oh, yeah, that was Nancy Reagan, so we'll just start legalizing everything. But here's something that hasn't changed. Homeland Security's slogan is still see something, say something. Hasn't changed, folks. But
Yeah.
if you don't know what you're looking for, you're never going to see it.
Yeah, you don't know to be aware of it. It just blends in with all the other noise that's going on in people's lives. Okay, so people can get the book by going to TDA Shadows, TDA Tom David Adam or Trinidad Aragua. TDAshadows.com. They can order the book. They can are they able to find out about training and how they can learn these things that they
Absolutely.
absolutely must know?
Yep. They can contact me right there. They can read about how the training works. It's very customizable. Like I said, this isn't hours and hours and hours of stuff. I am literally adjusting for everybody that reaches out to me so that I can fit it into their world. And then you can also find out the updates. It's kind of scary. It's hard to stay up on it all the time, but usually every day there's something new there about TDA and what's happening, or who's doing what, or what agency is reporting what. And I'm throwing bits of the book and history in there as well. So, you can go back. I think there's 8 pages of kind of blog posts, if you would, in there.
Well, that's terrific because the reality is our law enforcement's they're being caught off guard, and the dangers and the risk to law enforcement it's growing. And I certainly don't want to see gun battles on the street and unnecessary bloodshed. And law enforcement's going to have every tool available because if they haven't encountered TDA already, they're about to encounter them in their communities.
Right. Yeah, as a my firefighting background, believe it or not, overlays with law enforcement a little. And that is that it's very rare when a firefighter reports a fire. It's the public. And that system has worked for a long time. And it's worked pretty good. And our law enforcement right now is so inundated, so beat, so tired, so weary, so shorthanded. That's why the training is important. Because we need the American public now to start calling in smoke before there's a fire.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Eddie, thanks for being with us today. As we start to wrap things up, is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to make sure that people know about?
I think I want everybody to know that, again, it's election time. So everybody's looking for that political statement. What did he say? How can I pick it apart? And I think I would just ask that everybody understands this isn't a political issue. This is an issue about your family. This is your 12-year-old son who's being recruited. This is your 12-year-old daughter who could be laying in an alley tomorrow because of this. So this is a personal thing. You know, I believe that what we need to do is just start embracing our mistakes and moving forward. I had this conversation with my wife yesterday. I said, we need to start embracing our mistakes. And she hugged me. So that's how my day went.
That's awesome. Well, hug from your wife is always a good hug. So, Eddie, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. Folks, check out tdashadows.com for information about this threat that is, it's not at our borders. It's throughout our country. And you need to make sure you know what to look for. And when you do look for it, when you do see something and recognize, hey, this is an issue, don't be shy. Pick up the phone, see something, say something. Eddie, thanks again for being on the show. I look forward to having you on because you are an expert in so many different areas. When we talk about SMEs, subject matter experts, you check the box in a lot of different subjects. So look forward to having you on future podcast episodes. And thanks for taking your time. Definitely honored to have you here today.
Thank you. Thank you.
You are welcome. Thank you. Folks, make sure you check out theidea.world. Make sure you check out tdashadows.com. And if you need de-escalation training, come see us. You definitely need to be checking out tdashadows.com so you can be aware of that. Take advantage of Eddie's training. And until next time, as always, stay safe. Bye for now.